This episode of Historium is brought to you by Blueberry. Not the fruit, the podcast hosting service. Have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Well, now is the time, and Blueberry is what you should be using to host that podcast. Blueberry is the gold standard for podcast hosting and provides accurate stats, your own WordPress website, and an easy-to-use format for you to get your podcast out into the world. And right now, you can get your first month free. That's right, free. All you have to do is go to orbitaljigsaw.com/history. That's orbitaljigsaw.com/history and start your journey into podcasting right.
I'm Matt from 411 Gaming, and you're listening to Historium on the Orbital Jigsaw Network.
Over the course of human history, changes usually happen at an incredibly slow rate. But occasionally, things speed up to the point where it seems like so much is happening at once. These events are usually called revolutions, and they are some of my favorite parts of history. From the Industrial Revolution to the American Revolution to the Sexual Revolution, they all have something in common: radical change over a brief period of time. But there's one revolution that never gets the attention it deserves. But with the current president of the United States mentioning the country in one of his colorful comments, I figured it was time for this story to be told here. This week, we're talking about the mass slave uprising from the Haitian Revolution. I'm Jake Barton. Welcome to Historium, episode 27, Bittersweet Liberty. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue and arrived at an island in the Caribbean. He did not, in fact, discover the Americas. He simply arrived somewhere where countless others had been living for millennia. By the 1500s, the island Columbus landed on was known as Hispaniola. On the eastern side was the Spanish colony of Santo Domingo. However, the other parts of the island were largely ignored, and soon became safe havens for pirates of all kinds. Some French pirates settled in the western part of the island, where they found roaming cattle left behind by the Spanish when they headed to other areas in search of gold and silver. The French settlers made a good living out of making smoked beef jerky from these cattle, as pirates were in constant need of rations that wouldn't spoil. This smoked jerky was called bacon, after the French word for the mechanism used to smoke it. Bacon is also where we get the term buccaneer. These French settlers eventually found the cattle harder and harder to come by, so they sought out other forms of revenue. They found out that sugar grew exceptionally well in the climate, and soon sugar plantations began popping up all over the French side of Hispaniola, which the French just called Saint-Domingue. Soon, Saint-Domingue was producing sugar, coffee, and indigo at levels never before seen, fueling Europe's craving for the luxuries. By the end of the American Revolution, Saint-Domingue was producing 40% of Europe's sugar and 60% of Europe's coffee. By the 1700s, it was the most profitable colony in the world, the crown jewel of France's overseas empire, and the whole economy was based on enslaved human capital. Saint-Domingue had the largest slave population in the world, second only to Brazil, which, as you know, is much bigger than the small island of Hispaniola. Bottom line, there were a lot of slaves in Saint-Domingue. More slaves were shipped into the colony each year than the entire white population combined. Slaves outnumbered the whites 10 to 1, most of them being African natives, as the horrific working conditions did not allow many of the slaves to breed. In order to show you the horrific details of slavery, allow me to place you in the daily life of a Saint-Domingue slave. It was harvest time, so you've been up for 2, maybe 3 days. It was hard to keep track at this point. You're 24 years old, a full year older than the average life expectancy. You grew up in the Congo and were taken here as a teenager. Most everyone you have ever known has been tortured at some point, and many have already died. Two older white men with whips watch as you walk into the sugar field for what seems to be the millionth time. Alongside you are about a dozen others, each with visible lashing scars, and several missing an arm or a hand. Many were branded on several body parts. As you harvest the sugar, little pricks are made from the sugar stalks. Despite the salt from your sweat burning every minuscule nick and cut, you barely feel it anymore. You just wince and move on. Perhaps 100 yards away, you hear the wails of a younger slave, followed by the cracks of a whip, followed by silence. Once you gathered up enough sugar, your group heads in to take the harvested sugarcane to be extracted. You pass three skulls, flies buzzing around them, with some flesh still clinging to the bone. Last week, three slaves had been accused of stealing food. They had been buried up to their necks, and then had their faces lathered in honey. It took two full days for the bugs to eat enough of their flesh for them to finally die, with them screaming in agony the entire time. The white slave drivers found this hilarious, but now the skulls just sat alongside the road, serving as a reminder of what happened if you ever disobeyed. You've seen it all at this point. Beatings, lashings, pouring salt and spices into open wounds, beheadings, genital mutilation, pouring hot wax over slaves' heads, hangings, even executions where a slave would be hung upside down and their anus filled with gunpowder, and then the powder being lit. This was just a part of your life. You eventually arrive at the warehouse where the sugar was extracted. As you unload the sugarcane, one woman in your group falls over. A slave driver whipped her on the back, thinking she had fallen asleep, which was all too common. But she did not wake up. Eventually, after a few minutes, the man got tired of whipping her and ordered several other slaves to haul away the corpse. Above you are massive vats full of boiling sugarcane. Half a dozen women constantly stir the boiling material, each with hundreds of tiny white scars in their body from bubbles of boiling sugarcane popping near them. Behind you, you hear an altercation between a slave and a driver. The slave pushes the man before he can reach his whip and runs over to a vat of boiling sugar and jumps in. Boiling liquid splashed around for a few seconds before it was over. That was the third person you had seen commit suicide today. Your world is suffering, resentment, dehumanization, and pain, and that is all you will ever know. So those slaves amounted to about 90% of Saint-Domingue's population. But there are three other groups to account for. First is the Grand Blancs, or the Big Whites. These were the wealthiest of the wealthy due to the extreme financial success of the colony. They had so much wealth that they spent most of their time away from the island, managing their estate from France. The ones who did the grunt work, like managing the plantations and working as slave drivers, were the Petit Blancs, or Little Whites. They were also often employed as artisans or day laborers. The final group was the Mulattoes. These were the children of mixed race heritage and were often a product of rape. When slaves were impregnated, they were often freed by their owners, with the children being treated with a higher regard than a slave. This happened for generations, to where the mulattoes eventually made up a large portion of the population, and were granted considerable rights, with some even owning land and becoming quite wealthy in their own regard. Many served in the military. They often had extensive paperwork regarding their exact genetic makeup for various racist reasons. Nowadays, the term mulatto is considered a racial slur by some, so most modern historians refer to them as the free coloreds, so I will as well. Now, if you look at all the strange economic and racial relationships between these different groups, it's very obvious that this was not a recipe for permanent social stability. Tensions between the different groups had been growing since the colony's inception. Author Paul Fregosi puts it best, quote, "Whites, mulattoes, and blacks loathed each other. The poor whites couldn't stand the rich whites. The rich whites despised the poor whites. The middle-class whites were jealous of the aristocratic whites. The whites born in France looked down upon the locally born whites. Mulattoes envied the whites, despised the blacks, and were despised by the whites. Free Negroes brutalized those who were still slaves. Slaves hated their masters, and Haitian-born blacks regarded those from Africa as savages. Everyone, quite rightly, lived in terror of everyone else. Haiti was hell, but Haiti was rich." Unquote. In general, Saint-Domingue was seething with hatred. Fear of uprising was common among the whites on the island. Because of this, the slave drivers responded incredibly harshly to any form of disobedience. But slaves resisted frequently by deliberately slowing production, breaking machines, and occasionally poisoning white plantation owners. Many slaves escaped into the rough inland terrain. Oftentimes, masters wouldn't even try to pursue. knowing that the slaves that would escape were the most rebellious anyway, and it would be better to have those rebellious slaves in the jungle than on their own property, where they could potentially convince others to join them. By the mid-1700s, groups of escaped slaves began to grow into fully functioning societies. These runaways were called Maroons. Most groups of Maroons consisted of a few hundred runaways, while others numbered into the thousands. These bands of Maroons would conduct night raids on plantations and coordinate hunting expeditions in the wilderness to survive. These societies of runaway slaves practiced the religion of voodoo, which combined elements of West African traditions with elements of Roman Catholicism. Occasionally, plantation owners would venture inland with armed expeditions, but they often found the terrain too harsh, and these bands were reluctantly allowed to survive. However, these various groups of Maroons lacked the leadership for coordinated efforts. That all changed in the 1750s, when a charismatic one-armed man named Francois McCandle began uniting various Maroon groups through a complex communication network in both the slave plantations and the inland mountains. McCandle was a voodoo priest with an extensive knowledge of poisons. He distributed these poisons via his network of spies, and soon, whites on dozens of plantations began to drop dead. Both the Grand Blancs and the Petite Blancs lived in abject terror of being poisoned, and eventually they decided to do something about it. In early 1758, every slave that could even potentially be a spy was tortured to reveal information about McCandle. After hundreds of slaves had been tortured, most of them having nothing to do with the conspiracy, eventually they got answers. They pinpointed the location of the largest Maroon colony in the mountains. A battalion of French soldiers were dispatched to the area, and after taking a surprising amount of casualties, McCandle was captured. He was taken to the city square and burned at the stake. However, by this point, McCandle was a legendary figure, shrouded in myth. The local legend was that McCandle was a shapeshifter, and that he had turned into a fly and escaped before his body was consumed by the flames. Every time the slaves saw a fly land near them, they believed it could be that old voodoo priest from the mountains. The seeds of liberty had been planted, and the slaves now had a martyr. Tensions remained incredibly high, and by 1789, Saint-Domingue was at a boiling point. It turns out that tensions were also high back in France. In fact, it was the eve of revolution. In August of 1789, the new National Assembly made radical changes to France's laws. One of the most extreme changes was the publication of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which declared all men free and equal. The declaration was printed and distributed widely and eventually made its way to Saint-Domingue. Upon being released in the French colony, the Declaration of the Rights of Man excited nearly everyone, but each group took it in very different ways. The Grand Blancs viewed it as a way of potentially getting out of high royal taxes. The Petite Blancs and the Coloreds thought it a way for them to be treated as equals to the rich Grand Blancs. And the slaves interpreted it literally, that all men were equal. The next 2 years proved even more tumultuous. Enlightenment writer G. Raynal wrote of an impending storm in the Caribbean colonies and predicted large-scale uprisings and revolts. Later French writer Count Mirabeau wrote that the citizens of Saint-Domingue slept at the foot of Vesuvius. In 1791, radical revolutionaries in France declared that all colored landowners now had the same rights as whites. The Grand Blancs did the best they could to prevent the news from getting to the coloreds in Saint-Domingue, but despite their best efforts, it eventually did. The coloreds vouched for their rights, but the whites simply ignored them and ignored the order from France. However, the slaves had simply had enough at this point and planned for rebellion. On the evening of August the 21st, 1791, thousands of slaves attended a massive voodoo ceremony deep in the jungle. That night, an enormous tropical storm hit the island, which the voodoo priest interpreted as a sign from God. The slaves sang praises in the downpour and danced through the flashes of lightning before heading down the mountain to the plantations. The day of reckoning was here. The rain-soaked slaves broke into the estates and slaughtered the whites that lived there. Slaves turned on their masters and their white families. Screams echoed from the plantations. All throughout the night, black men and women destroyed plantation equipment and pillaged everything they came across. Their newfound freedom fueled an orgy of revenge. The storm passed, and the slaves continued going from plantation to plantation, freeing more of their brothers and sisters. Some coloreds were spared, others were not. They marched on. Within 2 weeks, the members of the slave revolt numbered over 100,000, and they had destroyed over 1,000 sugar and coffee plantations. Historians estimate that in the first few weeks alone, the rebellion had caused over 2 million francs in damages. By 1792, slave rebels controlled a full third of the island, with most surviving whites hiding out in the fortified coastal cities. And the rebels were just getting started. Meanwhile, back in France, the revolution was in full swing. The new government sent a short, portly man by the name of Sontenax to govern over the newly chaotic colony of Saint-Domingue. He arrived with 6,000 soldiers to a colony in disarray. Sontenax was an abolitionist and was not a fan of slavery. He empathized with the slave rebels, but found it difficult to support them when many of them believed that the King of France was the one that freed them in the first place. So he saw many of them as royalists. However, in March 1792, the revolutionary government in France issued the rights to all free men of color in their colonies. The French hoped this could stem some of the violence. It did not. But throughout the year, Sontenax continued the impossible task of juggling all the different sides of this conflict. Meanwhile, the slave rebels still controlled large swaths of the island. Throughout 1792, the rebels began getting better organized and a hierarchy emerged. One of the leaders was a man by the name of Toussaint Louverture. Toussaint was born a slave on a plantation, but apparently had a relatively kind master who saw promise in the young Toussaint. His master provided him with an education, and he was eventually freed and worked on his old master's plantation. He was a strong Catholic and has long been rumored to have been a member of the Freemasons. Toussaint was around 50 years old when the slave insurrection broke out. However, he did not join until later, when he realized the rebellion would not immediately be crushed. Toussaint was a rare combination, brilliant in terms of both combat effectiveness and structural organization. He began organizing the uprising and using his education to strengthen the ex-slaves' held territory. He wore a stolen French officer's uniform and was decked out in a leader's regalia. He led the black rebels in a series of brilliant victories that terrified the French. He made strict rules and enforced a system of ranks, creating a European-style army. He used any French officers that they captured to teach the ex-slaves how to fight more effectively. But he knew they couldn't do this alone. Two other factions saw this chaos in Saint-Domingue as an opportunity: the English and the Spanish. The English were terrified when they heard the news of the slave rebellion. Remember, they had just lost their North American colonies less than a decade before. They relied on their Caribbean plantations like Jamaica now more than ever. So the idea of a revolutionary France granting free people of color political rights made them fear people of color in their own plantations would ask for the same. England began a campaign to take the colony of Saint-Domingue. And many of the Grand Blancs supported them wholeheartedly, hoping that they would reinstitute slavery and with it their fortunes. If you remember, the eastern side of the island, called Santo Domingo, was controlled by the Spanish. Spain naturally sought control of the entire island, and they had the fleet to do it. The Spanish had heard many stories of the now legendary Toussaint Louverture and offered him a position as an officer in their navy. Louverture accepted and negotiated over plenty of supplies to support the Black Uprising. In September 1793, the British Royal Navy took the main French naval base in Saint-Domingue. Meanwhile, the Spanish were gaining ground in the east. The revolutionary government in Paris knew they were in a tough spot, being crushed between British and Spanish forces. They knew they had to do something, well, revolutionary. So they did. They freed all of the slaves in every French colony. A Frenchman named Danton, who was present at the National Convention when it abolished slavery, stated, quote, "Representatives of the French people, until now our decrees of liberty have been selfish and only for ourselves. But today, we proclaim it to the universe, and generations to come will glorify this decree. We are proclaiming universal liberty. We are working for future generations. Let us launch liberty into the colonies. The English are dead today." Unquote. The news shocked the world. Black men and women who had just a few years prior been working in chains and mistreated as field hands were suddenly free. Sontenax was overjoyed, as he was in favor of abolition for quite some time, but additionally, he now had thousands more men who could be put in French uniforms to fight for France. Toussaint Louverture was overjoyed to hear about the abolition of slavery. By now, he was a high-ranking officer in the Spanish military, and had actually been made a knight in the Order of Saint Isabella. However, the Spanish were still big fans of slavery, so Toussaint turned on his Spanish masters and sided with the now abolitionist French. Louverture and Sontenax each led their respective armies against the invading British. During the course of 1794, the French slowly took back positions that had been taken by the British, but Louverture and Sontenax couldn't take all the credit. The British troops began dropping like flies from what they called the Black Vomit, and what we now call Yellow Fever. British soldiers died by the thousands. The British historian Sir John Fortescue wrote, quote, "It is probably beneath the mark to say that 12,000 Englishmen were buried in the West Indies in 1794 alone," unquote. As the English were being decimated by the disease, the French army, mostly composed of free slaves, were fine. The cruel Darwinism had already taken its effect for them years ago, and the only men left alive were therefore immune. Going forward, the greatest ally of Saint-Domingue would be yellow fever. The British military leaders sent word of these losses back to London. William Pitt the Younger, the Prime Minister of England, decided to double down. He called for a plan he labeled the Great Push to capture Saint-Domingue and all of France's Caribbean colonies. He called for a fleet of 200 ships to transport 30,000 soldiers to take the island. Being sent to the colony of Saint-Domingue was considered a death sentence because of the yellow fever. Because of this, many regiments rioted, refusing to go. On top of this, inclement weather stalled the expedition for several months. The Great Push was off to a bad start, and that bad start was indicative of things to come. The British made landfall at Port-au-Prince, but took heavy losses on the way in, losing several ships of the line to French artillery fire. However, they eventually took the city, and thousands of English soldiers entered. They began setting up forts on the perimeter. One of these forts, Fort Churchill, was attacked by Toussaint's army. The British thought the ex-slave soldiers would fight like unorganized savages. However, they attacked with tactical precision. Under heavy artillery fire, the Haitians assembled ladders and attempted to scale a fortification. They were eventually beaten back, but the English were now terrified. These black men fought like a professional European army, and there were thousands more in the mountains. Toussaint Louverture was the man responsible for the military transformation, and the myth surrounding him continued to grow. However, the Haitians' strongest ally did most of the work. As the soldiers had feared, yellow fever simply annihilated them. Soldiers throughout Port-au-Prince began falling ill. The metallic smell of blood and vomit hung in the air wherever the soldiers stayed. The soldiers who didn't get the yellow fever spent nearly every waking hour burying the dead. The piles of corpses grew ever higher. And as they did, soldiers wrote home to their families and friends. One British officer wrote of the horror of seeing his friends, quote, "drown in their own blood while raving mad," unquote. With each letter home, public support of this great push weakened. By 1798, English officers met with Toussaint Louverture and offered to pull out of Saint-Domingue. Toussaint agreed to not promote any slave uprisings on British plantations in Jamaica. Toussaint agreed. The British withdrew from Saint-Domingue on August 31, 1798. The expedition to Saint-Domingue had cost the British treasury £4 million and 10,000 men, either dead or crippled, from the effects of yellow fever. Toussaint Louverture moved quickly to consolidate his power. The French commissioner Sontenax had been the man who issued the decree formally ending slavery in Saint-Domingue, and as a result was quite popular. Toussaint knew that Sontenax had to go, if he was to be the one to lead Saint-Domingue. Soon after the British left, he escorted Sontenax under armed guard to a ship sailing for France. Upon arrival back in France, Sontenax simply returned to his hometown. He died 16 years later, peacefully in his bed. A rare death for a revolutionary. Back in Saint-Domingue, a colored general by the name of André Rigaud saw the dispelling of Sontenax as an obvious power grab by Toussaint. he led a rebellion of his own against Louverture's army, what's now known as the War of Knives. Rigaud controlled the southern part of Saint-Domingue, known as Tiburon. Toussaint responded quickly. He sent his trusty second-in-command, a man by the name of Jean-Jacques Dessalines. Unlike Toussaint, Dessalines was a black supremacist. He was the bad cop to Toussaint's good cop, but he was a good commander with tendencies for bold, unexpected attacks. Dessalines took Toussaint's army south, crushing all resistance and forcing Rigaud to fall back to the city strongholds. At the tail end of the War of Knives, Toussaint and Louverture continued to show that he was not just an excellent battlefield commander and a brilliant organizer, but that he was a great diplomat as well. He wrote a letter to John Adams asking for American naval support in his siege of Rigaud's forces in the south. John Adams accepted, despite the United States' ongoing quasi-war with France. With the American naval blockade, Rigaud's men surrendered. But Toussaint wasn't done yet. He turned his army around and took the Spanish colony of Santo Domingo on the other side of the island, freeing all of the slaves there as well. Suddenly, Toussaint Louverture was the unquestioned ruler over all of Saint-Domingue and the entire island of Hispaniola. He expressed what he called his tricolor dream, the idea that blacks, whites, and coloreds could all live on the island in harmony, that no man was above another because the color of their skin. Despite basically being a dictator, Toussaint Louverture was beloved by his people. Many affectionately called him Papa Toussaint. However, Toussaint had some tough decisions to make, so this warm public opinion wouldn't last. Saint-Domingue was war-torn and war-weary. Toussaint knew that sugar was still the only way to fund the colony, so he enacted laws that forced laborers to stay in their plantations for certain amounts of time in order to keep up production. The men were being paid meager wages, but to them, this sure felt a lot like slavery. As a symbolic gesture, Toussaint banned the use of the whip on any plantation in the island. Overall, Louverture was leading the island well. However, Toussaint had defied French orders back when he took Santo Domingo, but he wasn't worried. France was entrenched in chaos, and the orders had come from someone he had never heard of, Napoleon Bonaparte. By this point, the French Revolution had reached its bloody conclusion. First Consul Bonaparte had survived assassination attempts from Royalists and Jacobins alike, and he had just made peace with England. Napoleon now planned on consolidating his own power in the French Republic. He ordered Toussaint Louverture to not provoke any war with Spain by taking Santo Domingo. Louverture disobeyed. He also found out that the Adams administration had been trading with Saint-Domingue almost as if it was an independent nation. Some even called Louverture the Black Bonaparte. Napoleon decided that there was only room for one military maverick in the fledgling French Republic, and it was going to be him. He convinced the Republic to send a massive expedition to Saint-Domingue to take back their sugar colony and fund their future endeavors. With an intentional vagueness, Napoleon all but announced he would reinstitute slavery after he took back the island. Many Grand Blancs who had fled Saint-Domingue during the initial slave uprising loved the idea, and French soldiers who were eager to plunder foreign riches loved the idea as well. Napoleon estimated the expedition would take 3 months. The mission would be led by his brother-in-law, Charles Victor Emmanuel Leclerc, and it would be a massive one. An armada of 80 ships transporting 31,000 men arrived in the bay outside Saint-Domingue. Toussaint Louverture stood in a fort overlooking the bay. One of his underlings reported that under his breath, Toussaint said, "We're all going to die." He apparently regained his composure because he sent out a general to every major port city with these orders: if the French make landfall, burn the city to the ground and retreat to the mountains. The armada split, and the first group attacked the city of Le Cap, and Le Cap burned to the ground. This happened at every port city in Saint-Domingue. In some cases, the fires were put out or isolated, minimizing the damage, but in other areas, entire cities turned to ash. The entirety of Louverture's army retreated inland to the recently constructed secondary forts. After gaining their bearings, the French followed. They had wisely planned the Leclerc expedition for the time of year when the yellow fever virus was mostly dormant. However, the fighting wasn't easy. In a letter to Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Toussaint outlined his plans for defeating the French. Quote, Do not forget, while waiting for the rainy season which will rid us of our foes, that we are to have no other resource than destruction and fire. Bear in mind that the soil bathed with our sweat must not furnish our enemies with the smallest sustenance. Tear up the roads with shot, throw corpses and horses into all the foundations, burn and annihilate everything, in order that those who have come to reduce us to slavery may have before their eyes the image of the hell which they deserve." Unquote. By this point, Toussaint had sent a letter to the United States, asking for naval support once again. However, John Adams, who admired Louverture, was no longer in office. His successor was none other than Thomas Jefferson, a slave-owning Francophile. The Haitian request to the Americans had fallen on deaf ears. Toussaint, now deep in the mountains, intended the French to pay for every inch of the ground they took, and they absolutely did. Due to the rough jungle terrain and the home field advantage of the blacks, French casualties were staggering. When the French did take a fort, the Haitian soldiers immediately set it ablaze and retreated deeper into the mountains. On several occasions, the black troops set traps and even rolled boulders down mountain passes, crushing oncoming French soldiers. Dessalines especially had made an art out of destroying the morale of the French. The Haitian psychological warfare was successful. Many French soldiers asked why they were in the jungle fighting to enslave the Haitians, who were only asserting rights promised by their own revolution. But they were pushed on. Slowly, the French were gaining ground. But sure enough, Dessalines and Louverture made them pay for every inch. Leclerc, amazed by the tenacity of the black soldiers they were facing, asked Napoleon for more men. Napoleon began sending thousands of Polish and Swiss mercenaries to supplement Leclerc's troops. The momentum shifted when Henri Christophe, a general on Toussaint's side, defected to the French. With him came the knowledge of the mountain passes and ways to surround Louverture. Leclerc sent a message to Toussaint, promising that the French would not reinstitute slavery if he surrendered. Probably tired from 11 years of war, and doing what he hoped was best for his people, he agreed. Louverture came down the mountains and formally surrendered on May 6, 1802. He was assured his black officers and soldiers would be integrated into the French military. Toussaint, however, was deceived. As soon as he arrived in the capital, he was seized and taken to a ship to be sent off to France. While aboard, he famously told his captors that his successors would not make the same mistake in trusting them, saying, quote, "In overthrowing me, you have cut down in Saint-Domingue only the trunk of the Tree of Liberty. It will spring up again from the roots, for they are numerous and they are deep." Unquote. Louverture, for the first time in his life and against his will, crossed the Atlantic Ocean. He was taken to a prison in France. After a few months of imprisonment, he died of unknown causes at the age of 60. Toussaint Louverture's death cannot be overstated. His political, diplomatic, and organizational brilliance were essential to much of the Haitian Revolution. His presence, and lack thereof, completely changes the course and tone of the rest of the revolution. He had sailed Saint-Domingue through trials and tribulations and ultimately to freedom, but it would be left to other men to lead it to independence. Napoleonic control of the island went well enough at first. Many rebels still hung on in the jungle, but Dessalines' main force was no longer fighting against French control. That is, until Leclerc tried to take their guns. At this point, Dessalines began to realize that Leclerc had been lying about everything, and that Napoleon did, in fact, plan to reinstitute slavery. When his black troops were off in the jungle fighting guerrilla bands with the French, he secretly ordered them to turn on the whites and kill them all. Leclerc was hit with more bad luck when Haiti's best ally, yellow fever, came back in force. Hundreds of French died each day. Yellow fever ravaged the French troops, with hundreds of soldiers dying every single day. Huge auctions were held for French warships because there weren't enough Frenchmen to man them anymore. Leclerc spent each day barricaded in his quarters, terrified the disease might get in. He was growing more paranoid by the day. When he heard the news of Dessalines telling his troops to turn on white French soldiers, he was furious. His paranoia turned to fury. He ordered every single black man in Le Cap to be killed. Hundreds of black and colored men most of them completely loyal to France, were taken out to the harbor. They then had a rock or large brick tied to their neck and were thrown in the bay. This ignited rebellion throughout all of Saint-Domingue once again. But this time, it was about one thing, race. Despite being somewhat disliked for his cruelty and tactics, Dessalines managed to unite everyone of African descent under one banner. He reorganized the black soldiers to a single unit, calling it the Indigenous Army. Back in Le Cap, Leclerc's worst fears came true. He began falling ill. Throwing up blood and running a high fever, the brother-in-law of Napoleon Bonaparte died unceremoniously at the age of 30, thousands of miles from his home. The next officer in the French chain of command was a man by the name of Rochambeau, who had played a minor part in the American Civil War. There's one important thing you need to know about Rochambeau. He was a seething racist. In his letters, he refers to any man with African background as an escaped slave, regardless of if they were free or not. He brought the level of cruelty in Saint-Domingue up to an unprecedented level. See, Rochambeau seemed to take delight in capturing and torturing blacks, and he did it so often that he had plenty of sick nicknames for the various forms of torture. Drowning a black man was called giving a codfish a bath. Drowning several black people was called netting a big catch. Hanging was called promoting. Crucifying a black man was called raising him up. And burning black people at stake was called a hot operation. Other forms of torture from the French included locking blacks in the hold of a ship and filling it with sulfur gas, and having black people fight each other in arenas at gunpoint. Perhaps the worst act of cruelty was the dogs. Rochambeau ordered several thousand hunting dogs from Cuba, mostly bulldogs and mastiffs. He then forbid his men from feeding them. He said the dogs would eat only viande des negres, the flesh of blacks. He let loose the dogs of war, and they ravaged men before the Frenchmen's very eyes. The Polish and Swiss mercenaries that managed to survive the yellow fever realized that they were taking orders from a madman. They abandoned their post and either fled or attempted to join the Black Rebellion. Dessalines was equally brutal, though. He responded to each French act of cruelty with an act of his own, sawing women in half and putting white people's heads on pikes near every major road in Saint-Domingue. The cycle of cruelty seemed to have no end. But in May 1803, the tide began to change. Dessalines met with black and colored leaders from throughout Saint-Domingue. He convinced them that he could rid the French from the island once and for all if they trusted him. They eventually said they would, and Dessalines took the red, white, and blue French flag and tore out the center white strip. He then fashioned the red and blue strips back together. The message was clear. Whites had no place in Dessalines' new plan. Toussaint's tricolor dream was no more. Dessalines was offered support from American and English naval vessels as they sought an opportunity to do some damage to Napoleon's France. They blockaded the ports of Saint-Domingue and forced the French to a singular stronghold. The stage was set. On November 18, 1803, under their new flag, they stormed the stronghold where the French were gathered. A heavy downpour drenched the battlefield, but the Haitians fought through the mud for hours to eventually take the fort. Under a torrential downpour with lightning flashing, the Haitians celebrated their victory. The initial slave revolt all those years ago began under a violent storm. It was fitting that it ended under one as well. Suddenly, they were free. Several men in Dessalines' army watched a fly land on a French corpse and smiled. The French forces were given 10 days to leave. All of the officers were forced to turn themselves in to the British. The Leclerc expedition ended in complete and utter failure, with the French losing 50,000 men to disease alone. The French living in the major port cities heard of the atrocities inflicted by Dessalines and did everything they could to board a ship and leave Saint-Domingue for good. Thousands of French families left everything they owned to board a ship going anywhere but here. At this point, Napoleon had given up on his dream of a new world empire. It was during this period that the United States was given an amazing deal on a large swath of land in the middle of North America. Today, we call it the Louisiana Purchase. In December of 1803, Dessalines began organizing a formal government. The generals decided to call the country Haiti, what it was called by the native people before colonialism took hold. He had his undersecretary write the new nation's constitution. His quote before writing it shows the kind of future desired by the new regime. Quote, "For our Declaration of Independence, we should have the skin of a white man for parchment, his skull for an inkwell, his blood for the ink, and a bayonet for a pen." Unquote. On New Year's Day of 1804, Dessalines declared Haiti a free republic and read the strongly worded constitution to a cheering crowd. In the coming months, Dessalines called for, well, there's no other word for it, genocide. He called for every white man, woman, and child to be immediately killed. Any poor French families that couldn't afford to buy passage out of Haiti were hunted down and publicly executed. Dessalines formed death squads to march to every city and kill every non-black they could find. They offered mercy to anyone who brought them valuables, but ended up killing them anyway, just so they wouldn't have to search for their valuables. No one was spared. To many, this was justified. The head general Henry Christophe's secretary wrote this when asked if he believed the massacre to be moral. Quote, "Have they not hung up men with heads downward, drowned them in sacks, crucified them on planks, buried them alive, crushed them in mortars? Have they not forced them to consume feces? Have they not flayed them with the lash? Have they not cast them alive to be devoured by worms or onto anthills, or latched them to stakes in the swamp to be devoured by mosquitoes? Have they not thrown them in boiling cauldrons of cane syrup? Have they not put men and women inside barrels studded with spikes and rolled them down mountainsides into the abyss? Have they not consigned these miserable blacks to man-eating dogs until the latter, sated by human flesh, left the mangled victims to be finished off with bayonet and sword?" Unquote. Men who were previously slaves attributed every bit of their suffering to any of the surviving whites. In the end, around 4,000 white civilians were slaughtered. To be fair, the slaughter may not have been entirely racial. Dessalines treated the Polish and Swiss soldiers that had defected to his side with the utmost respect, actually offering them plots of land in the new nation. Many accepted. Additionally, Dessalines encouraged the Americans to be trading partners with them. So the racial aspect of the slaughter may be questioned, but the insane cruelty of it cannot be. In the end, 200,000 Haitians died in the revolution, a full third of Haiti's pre-war population. For the most part, Haiti was in shambles. Entire cities had been burned to the ground. Plantation equipment had been destroyed. Roads had been damaged beyond repair. You couldn't walk a few dozen feet without running into a rotting corpse. Overall, the infrastructure of Haiti was decimated. I'd like for a brief moment to explore an alternate history. One where Toussaint Louverture was not killed. One where Napoleon never sent a Leclerc expedition. Where he allowed Toussaint to run Haiti as a Commonwealth of France. There would be thousands less dead. So little damage done in comparison. No massacre of the whites. Papa Toussaint's tricolor dream would have lived on. Instead, he died in a small cell, an ocean away from his home, which had been destroyed. So Haiti had to rebuild. Dessalines issued more laws about plantation work, forcing laborers to remain on plantations for at least a year. Even after all of the violence of revolution and their eventual freedom, most Haitians' lives had barely changed at all. They were laboring in sugar fields all day, but earning meager wages this time. A change, perhaps, but a slim one. Several economic issues plagued Haiti from day one. First was that despite declaring independence, no other country on earth even recognized it as legitimate. Everyone believed the French would send another expedition at any time and would take their colony back. Even the United States, despite sharing so much in common with the fledgling nation, refused to acknowledge their existence. In fact, the Monroe Doctrine, which famously attempted to prevent European nations from intervening in the Americas, excluded Haiti. This is probably because what happened in Haiti was horrifying to most plantation owners in the American South. They believed the idea of a mass slave uprising could spread to the U.S. In fact, many scholars believe that Haitian independence sowed the seeds for the Civil War even further, with Northern abolitionists empathizing with the revolution, and Southerners terrified that something like it could happen there. This lack of recognition and legitimacy led to trade embargoes from various European countries for decades, which hampered Haiti financially, as most of the Haitian economy was based around exporting sugar and coffee. Additionally, Haiti spent way too much on their military. See, the threat of Napoleon sending another expedition or another European power deciding to invade kept Haiti vigilant about keeping up a strong military. Perhaps too vigilant. Over 10% of the population still actively served in the military, despite not being at war with anyone. Most strong young males served in the army, which meant far less manpower on plantations. The Haitians lived in constant fear of another war, but that war never came, and all of the money spent on defense could have been spent rebuilding some of the young country's war-torn infrastructure. While another French military force never came, something maybe much worse did. In 1825, French diplomats arrived in Haiti demanding war reparations for the loss of the Grand Blanc's plantations, as well as the loss of the value of their slaves. They started at 150 million francs. The negotiations were very one-sided, as France had several warships anchored in the harbor, but they eventually settled on 60 million francs for the French to formally recognize Haiti's independence. Haiti's current military budget was so high that France offered a loan to Haiti, albeit at insane rates. The Haitians were coerced to accept. Because of these rates, it took the people of Haiti well over 100 years to pay off. They finally paid their last payment in 1947. Adjusted for today's money, Haiti paid France a total of $21 billion. On top of trade embargoes and war reparations and debt, Haiti had more problems. You see, planting the same crop over and over irreparably harms the soil, and plantation owners had been doing that with sugar for centuries. Growing sugar, Haiti's main source of economic prosperity, became more and more difficult. All of these combined factors do not create an environment of economic prosperity. And that's without mentioning the various hurricanes and earthquakes that have hit the country since. But Haiti and the Haitian Revolution matter. The Haitian Revolution was the most successful slave uprising of all time. Haiti, more than any other country in the Age of Revolutions, believed in the idea that no one should be a slave. So when anyone brings up Haiti's poverty or calls it a shithole country, just remember that Haiti stood up for the weak when no one else did. Historium was written and produced by me, Jake Barton. Historium is a proud member of the Orbital Jigsaw Network. If you're a fan of Historium, you can follow it on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. If you'd like to support my work, you can donate to Historium on Patreon. This episode was super long, but I had a blast making it, so I hope you liked it. As always, thanks for listening.